This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. You can't open a paper or get your daily dose of radio or TV news without hearing about the results of the latest political poll. Campaign season used to be the only time when pollsters were taking the pulse of the nation. Now they're working around the clock. Stanley Greenberg is the official pollster for the Democratic National Committee and has worked for President Clinton both before and after he took over the White House. In fact, Greenberg is credited with helping to shape and refine the issues that led to Clinton's victory in 1992. Stanley Greenberg has just written a book, Middle Class Dreams, about the aspirations and frustrations of today's middle class. It's based on long-term research he's done in Macomb County, Michigan, which is a largely middle-class suburb that has, in the past, supported both Republicans and Democrats. Like many other pollsters and pundits, Greenberg has been trying to make sense of the midterm elections of 1994, which swept many Democrats out of office and brought a Republican majority to both houses of Congress.
Conventionally, people look at 94 and say it's a reversal of 92, and 92 a reversal of 88. I actually think there are two chapters in the same story. They represent voters turning away from the major parties, the major institutions in the country, with voters feeling a sense of betrayal and looking for something much bigger out of our politics. Specifically, 94, people had great hopes for the Democrats when they assumed office in 93 and for the president. People concluded in 94 that they hadn't delivered, that the high hopes had been ill-founded. It was not a statement about the president and his agenda and his vision. There's lots of evidence to suggest otherwise.
Well, let me just jump in and ask you to clarify that, because many have said that the results were a repudiation of the Clinton presidency. What kind of evidence do you have that it wasn't?
Well, I mean, voters at the time that they were casting their votes to throw out the crowd in Washington were saying that they preferred the Clinton course, the Clinton policies, to going back to Reagan policies at the very time they were doing it. Exit polls that were held immediately after the election and post-election surveys found voters saying, indeed, they wanted to cut spending, but they also wanted to see the country take care of health care. They wanted Social Security protected. So voters came away from this election with a quite mixed, and some would say contradictory, agenda. But I actually think it's only contradictory if you don't focus on the scale of the changes that they're looking for.
Well, let me ask you about the strategic guide to the 1994 election. I believe you had a hand in writing that guide. And this was a guide full of suggestions for Democrats running for office, saying run on your accomplishments, run on the home issues. And it seemed almost implicit in that was don't ally yourself with the sitting president.
Well, I mean, that was a narrow interpretation of what I wrote, because I said in that same report that the voters were more inclined to support you if you backed the president's policies. What I said in that is that voters looked on the what was happening in the country in 94. They saw all the white water mess. They saw a whole variety of foreign policy problems. They saw health care stalled. They saw a mess around the crime bill. And voters looked at the spectacle in Washington and said, this is our interests aren't being served in this. Things aren't happening for the benefit of the country. What we urged was that people running for office identify with what was happening, the specific accomplishments in Washington that they took ownership of. We didn't tell them to walk away from the deficit reduction program, the economic program, not to walk away from the crime bill. We said take ownership of those in terms of your own people back home, not for the people in Washington.
About, again, the election results of the 1994 midterm elections, most people did not go to the polls. And many of the races, think of the one here in Pennsylvania for the Senate, were extraordinarily close races. Looking at that, at those results, what do you think the non-voters were saying?
Well, I actually do think the non-voters had a big statement in 94, because the people who didn't vote tended to be younger non-college graduates. These are the voters who've watched the new economy with apprehension, who've watched their incomes remain stagnant now over a number of decades, and they are coming to believe that there is a permanent decline in an opportunity. And they're frustrated by a politics that does not appear to address the economic issues in a big way. And those are the voters who stayed home in 94. There was obviously some minority stay home, but that's not where the main focus was of non-participation. It was downscale younger voters, both men and women, whose incomes were stagnant. It's going to be very important for 96, both for the president and anybody who runs against the president, to address this changing economy and how it is people have rising incomes and stronger families in this period.
Well, how would you say then each of the major parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, has failed the American voter?
Well, if you look back on the roles the parties have played in this century since the 1890s, each of the parties has had a quite distinctive vision about how the country was to progress, how it is people were to be more prosperous. The Republicans came to power in 1896 for three decades, forged in depression. They set out to build an industrial America. They had a vision that said if a business prospered, the ordinary American would prosper. And ordinary citizens went along and believed in that. And there was a three-decade ascendance in which Republicans built the idea of top-down prosperity. Democrats came to power in 1932, again forged in depression, with the idea that if we could raise the living standards of the common person, that the country itself would be more prosperous. And for three decades, they ruled with that idea. So for a good part of a century, the country heard two quite clear views of how it is the country would progress and how it is ordinary people working hard would have better lives for themselves and their families. By the 1960s, both of those visions were quite tarnished, and there were two failed attempts at renewal. Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which voters came to see very quickly as a failure and too narrow, focused only on the disadvantaged, and the Republican vision under Ronald Reagan, who tried to renew the Republican idea of top-down prosperity, but quickly came to be seen as greedy. So voters came to see both of these parties as betraying their historic images, and while they seek advantage on small issues, they're not offering the kinds of visions that allow people to believe the country can prosper.
I think that the general opinion today is that the Republican and Democratic Party are interchangeable, the kind of Tweedledum, Tweedledee approach that one hears, and that the public sees both these parties as people who live privileged lives. They're associated with government waste, with lobbyists. Both parties have stayed away from campaign finance reform. Would you say those criticisms are warranted?
I say they're real and they're warranted. What's striking about the 94 election, while there was a change of party and seemed to be historic, what was more striking was that both parties had fallen to their lowest levels since the history of polling in public esteem. They stood at a kind of disreputable parity. And voters believe that politics had become arrogant. Congress was the symbol of it. Congress was seen as an arrogant place where people lived the life of privilege and forgot ordinary citizens. But I think those feelings about politics grow in a period when people have lost confidence that the major parties and the leaders of those parties know where they're taking the country.
We're talking today on Fresh Air with pollster Stanley Greenberg, and he's a pollster for the president and an advisor to the Democratic National Committee and author of a book called Middle Class Dreams. Your book focuses on a particular section of the country. It's Macomb County, Michigan. Describe this county for us. What's distinctive? What's important about Macomb County, Michigan?
Well, it's kind of a caricature of suburban America where these stories have played out. The ordinary citizens, as they began to prosper after World War II, moved out to these suburban communities, people bought their first homes, they had bought their first or second cars, and began to think of their children going to college, and they were really living the American dream. And for many of these voters who moved into the suburbs, they remained Democratic. Macomb County was the most Democratic suburban county in the country for John Kennedy in 1960. But by 1984, this became the home of Reagan Democrats. Macomb County went overwhelmingly for Ronald Reagan, as after the riot, after the civil rights movement, the riots, the busing controversy, these voters came to believe that Democrats no longer understood their lives, voted overwhelmingly for Ronald Reagan, only to turn against Ronald Reagan's vision and pull back from George Bush and increasing numbers to vote for independent candidates like Ross Perot. So this story has played out, in the sense of betrayal has played out in Macomb County.
Are the people of Macomb County the silent majority then that Nixon referred to back in the 60s and early 70s?
They're the silent majority, and they're spread all over the country. Not every suburban community has their Macomb County as such, but the voters who've been through that story can be found all over the country. I called the book Middle Class Dreams, not Middle Class Revolt, because these voters in these suburban counties like Macomb really still do long for politics to serve a public purpose and to help make their lives better. And they're not looking just to be in revolt. They don't want to just be angry rebels. They want something more out of public life. And that's the challenge facing our political leaders.
Do these people want to pay less taxes?
They want to pay less taxes, though. I think that the desire for less taxes is in the framework of a wasteful government that is with political leaders who they think are indulging themselves and who are arrogant and lost touch. When you ask voters what they would do right now, whether they would reduce the deficit or cut taxes, they overwhelmingly say reduce the deficit. I think voters want purposeful government that represents the interests of the average person. In that context, I think people are willing to put resources and protect the resources that have gone to government. If they think government is wasteful and arrogant, then they don't want to pay taxes to such an institution.
Well, for instance, and if I can just get you to be specific, are the people in this county in Michigan in favor of building more prisons in order to deal with the problems of crime? Or are they more likely to think, well, maybe we should invest in midnight basketball, to raise a loaded issue?
I don't think this is the home of midnight basketball. These voters have, are tough-minded on crime. They have been for some time. They would like to see. They don't understand why criminals end up out on the street with shortened sentences, and so they want to see a tougher penal system and very supportive of it. At the same time, they're supportive of millage, in millage elections of school funding. They want to see good, good schools. They are very protective of the environment. In Macomb County, which is on the lake, has a large number of boats, and its member of Congress is head of the boating caucus. But they're very strong environmentalists. They want clean lakes, clean groundwater. They want a decent quality of life, and they want their kids to do better. It doesn't fit a normal conservative liberal, spectrum. They cut across those lines. It's why they voted Republican for Senate and governor this year, but voted Democratic for Congress. They're focused on their own lives and a stronger community, and they want to support a politics that'll improve it.
Well, we were talking about the 1994 election results. Let's go back 2 years to the Clinton victory in 1992. You were one of the architects of the campaign. Without a clear majority from the American people, what mandate do you think the president had back in 1992?
I think he had a mandate for change. Richard Nixon was elected in 1968 with 43% of the vote. But no one had trouble understanding that the Wallace vote and the Richard Nixon vote in 1968 represented a rejection of the liberal Democratic New Deal majority that had been in power. I think voters knew when they voted for Bill Clinton and Ross Perot that they were voting to bring the curtain down on Reaganism and to seek a new kind of politics. So I think the 43% of 92 has as much power as the 43% of 68. The president in a two-way race, all the polls showed that, would have gotten a clear majority. And voters wanted to see a more activist but leaner government that was going to make it possible for middle-class America to have rising living standards.
What do you say, though, to even the supporters of the president, people who voted for him, who criticize him for not standing up to the power structure, even the Democratic Party in Congress, for waffling on a number of his nominees for cabinets, for not standing up for specific issues, and for not being able to articulate his vision?
This was a president who proposed very bold deficit reduction and spending reductions after, you know, years of rising deficits. You're going to have 3 and probably 4 years of a falling deficit. Who supported NAFTA against his own party, who proposed very bold health care reform where no president before has had the courage to go forward, proposed a crime bill that Congress had not been able to pass for, you know, 7 years because it combined the assault weapon ban with tough sentencing. These are bold initiatives. I actually am impatient with the critique. I think he's taken very strong stands, fought very hard, in a context where he's had a relatively small majority in the Congress, where the Republicans have been implacably opposed, and has fought to try to, you know, to make those accomplishments.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we're going to talk some more. My guest today is pollster Stanley Greenberg, and he's a pollster to the President of the United States. He's also advisor to the Democratic National Committee and author of a book called Middle Class Dreams. We're going to talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pollster Stanley Greenberg. What do you think of the Republican contract with America?
I think it's a contrivance. It was not a mandate created in the election itself. As you know, the contract was never advertised by the Republican National Committee in any of their multimillion-dollar national campaigns. One is hard pressed to find a Republican candidate anywhere in the country who ever mentioned the contract in their campaigns. But it was a very good device after the election for saying that a mandate existed. But I think Republicans are seeing quite quickly now, just a couple months into this, voters did not vote for the scale of cutback and slashing of purposeful government that they're moving to accomplish in this period. There's been a 20-point rise in the percentage of people saying they're going too far in cutting government spending. Voters did not think they were voting for the end to regulation in the environment and consumer safety. I think the Republicans are going to very quickly find themselves at odds with mainstream America, and we're going to have a quite contested reality looking very different from the one that we're in now.
Do you think, though, it taps into the public desire for less government, for less government waste?
Sure it does. The public wants less waste. They want less obtrusive government. They want leaner government. They're absolutely clear. So does the president. And the president's reinventing government program is about that. And there's 100,000 real bureaucrats who aren't there anymore, and 300,000 who will not be there when he runs for re-election. So reduced government is a given, whether it's Democrat or Republican. If you don't get that piece, you're not part of the current dialogue.
Why do you think the president hasn't gotten the kind of public acclaim for his efforts to reduce government that the Republicans are getting now?
Well, these things happen in the middle of controversy. The president has carried out his program largely administratively rather than through congressional battles, high-profile congressional battles, so the public tends not to see it. I think the test for the president will be come 96 on whether people look back on the 4 years and if they see a more stable economy over 4 years, whether they see decline in size of government, whether they see deficit down 4 years in a row, whether they conclude that this was real change. I think we're only at halftime. I just think it's too early to tell how people are going to evaluate the president.
Well, you mentioned the economy, and in the past, if the economy was in pretty good shape, the country not in a recession, if unemployment was down, jobs up, productivity up, that, of course, describes today, then the president would get credit for a good economy. It's interesting that in 1995, the public doesn't seem to feel good about the economy when economists say there are lots of things to feel good about. I mean, does that confound you as a pollster?
No. In fact, the book actually spends a fair amount of time exploring that that problem, that most people have come through this period, even a period of growth, with stagnant or declining incomes. They see restructuring taking place around them. They think it's a very unstable period, and it's likely to become more unstable. And probably the more they hear about these good economic statistics, I think the more they resent the official view of the economy. The unofficial view is the predominant view out in the real world, and political leaders are not going to break through until they have a better sense of the way people understand their lives. I think they're close. The real people are actually closer to understanding the real economy than the economists, and any leader's economic vision is going to have to come to terms with the stagnant incomes.
Well, you're the president's pollster. How often do you meet with him?
It varies by the the period of time that we're in. This has emerged, I think, as a fairly strong White House under Leon Panetta's leadership since over the last 6 months. And this is taking shape as we move toward 96. But this is also a period where governing is probably the most important thing that has to happen now. I think it would be wrong for the administration to be, I think, tempted by the presence of Republican presidential candidates or even the speculation of Democratic ones to get too mired in politics. I think the best strategy for the president in this period is to be a great president.
Well, let me ask you, though, about your work and its influence on policies coming from the White House. The latest figures I have for 1993 was that the Democratic National Committee spent nearly $2 million for polls, most of that money going for polls for the White House. I believe that that's a record. To what degree are you polling on specific policies?
Every president and both of the parties do voter research. It's a part of the way these things work. If you go back to Franklin Roosevelt, he had his pollster under Dwight Eisenhower, and polling was done secretly by the out of the State Department. For Dwight Eisenhower, polling on issues such as where the lines should be drawn as a part of an armistice in the Korean War. Richard Nixon had polling done on when the incursion into Cambodia and the bombing of North Vietnam. So polling has been a part of the presidency for a long period. There's nothing, I don't think, particularly unique about the level of polling that takes place here. But I can tell you, I've never polled on the president's agenda. That is what he should be fighting for. I never polled on health care, for example, until virtually the entire package was set. I've done research to look at how it is we, best make the case. But for policies that have been set by the president's priorities, I think that's appropriate, and it's not out of scale what's happened with previous presidents.
Is there too much polling, especially during a presidential race?
Yes, I think there's too much polling. I think there's too much immediacy. There's too much reporting about the horse race rather than the ideas that people offer. It's part of the problem I talked about earlier. People do want the elections to be about ideas. The press and the candidates tend to make it about process and the horse race, and the polls tend to feed that.
Stanley Greenberg is pollster to the president and advisor to the Democratic National Committee and author of Middle Class Dreams. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.